Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. You are the only case we have for oral submission on the 3 o'clock docket, so you will have all our attention for oral submission. The other cases are submitted on briefs. I understand both sides are ready, so well, let me introduce the panel to you before we begin. To my right is Justice Bill Meyer.
Afternoon.
To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dofano. Make it.
The court will now call Wilhelm versus Frank, Ms. Katie Klinke to argue for appellant, and Mr. Dan Chern to argue for appellee.
Ready?
May I approach, Your Honor?
I'm sorry?
May I approach?
Please. And if you just start talking, the light will magically turn green.
Okay. Thank you. May it please the court. This is kind of a challenging issue, I believe, because these are brother and sister who had a disagreement, basically, regarding the purchase of some property. Ms. Wilhoit is an 82-year-old lady, and Mr. Frank is also an elderly gentleman, several years younger than Ms. Wilhoit. The property that is in question is a property that is the home of Ms. Wilhoit. According to the records and documentation, the property was purchased by Mr. Frank, and it was placed in both Ms. Wilhoit's name and in Mr. Frank's name. Her as a single person, he as a married person. There was no contract between Mr. Frank and Ms. Wilhoit. Mr. Frank argues that he purchased the property under a oral agreement between the parties. Ms. Wilhoit argues that he had told her he was going to give her a gift, and he was going to buy her a home and move her closer to him. She lived around the Ennis area. The property was found and purchased, and Ms. Wilhoit moved to the Aubrey, Texas area. After she moved into the Aubrey, Texas area, she met a gentleman, a Charles Candy, who she subsequently married, and thereafter the conflict arose between Ms. Wilhoit and Mr. Frank. As far as the home, Mr. Frank argues that it belongs to him because she never paid him back and she was supposed to sell her house in Ennis and repay him. There's no writing. There's absolutely no documentation as to that. Pelley argues is that the court can't consider whether or not there was a statute of frauds issues, which is what is the main primary issue here, because Ms. Wilhoit tried this case on her own. She had hired a lawyer who worked with her and actually had drafted a motion for summary judgment regarding the statute of fraud issue and also a 2602 issue regarding the loan, because there was no writing regarding any loan on the property. Mr. Frank did not do a mortgage on the property. He did not write anything as far as a contract for a loan on the property. There was nothing other than the deed of trust, which showed that both the parties owned the property. Wilhoit was a businessman. He owned a business that he sold for a considerable amount of money, $2+ million, according to what disinterested friend of both parties said, and also in trial testimony, and also what he told Ms. Wilhoit. In regard to the argument that there was nothing before the court regarding the statute of frauds issue, the attorney that Ms. Wilhoit had prior to him leaving her employment did file a motion for a summary judgment based on the statute of frauds issue, and I believe this court has the responsibility and can go back and look at that issue.
That was never heard by the trial court, though, was it?
It may not have been. I was not there. I saw an order, but I'm sorry, I don't remember if there was any testimony on that.
Normally there wouldn't be testimony on a motion for summary
Well,
judgment. Did the court rule on the motion for summary judgment?
I thought she denied it, Your Honor, but I may be wrong. I may be thinking of something else. And if I am, I apologize. My client didn't have the full record. I came down and got the record, read the record, then brought it back. So I do apologize. As far as the preserving, I believe that a court, whenever there is people like Ms. Wilhoit who has no attorney, goes to the court to try to get justice, and she is not able to understand the rulings of the court. She is not able to object properly. Her primary objection was, he's lying. That was her primary objection to everything. As far as the meeting of the minds, if there was a contract, as Mr. Frank argues there was and testified that there was, there certainly couldn't have been a meeting of the minds when she jumps up and says, you're lying. There's an argument that there was nothing as far as Ms. Wilhoit's concerned. The evidence as far as a contract is only the pro evidence. There is nothing else other than pro evidence. Under 2602, if there's a loan for over $50,000, and this house was supposed to be worth $145,000, is what Mr. Frank paid for it, then there should have been some kind of contract regarding the house if it was a loan. If it was a mortgage, then he should have put a lien on the property. There should have been something else besides his testimony that there was an agreement and her testimony that there was an agreement. The reason the statute of frauds was written was to protect the innocent parties. And in this situation, the innocent party is Ms. Wilhoit, who depended on her brother to do what he said, to buy the property, which he did. She sold her property. He sold a lot of her personal items, trailers, tractors, things of that nature. And then she moved to Denton. What Mr. Frank would ask the court to do is something very extraordinary. What he wants the court to do is go behind a filed document, the deed of trust, the warranty deed, and to change that or amend that warranty deed and make it either a deed to himself or put a contract into that deed. I just don't believe that that's something that the courts should do. It's not anticipated under the statute of frauds, and it's not anticipated by innocent third parties such as taxing agencies or taxing authorities, contractors, anyone else who would have an interest in whether this title was clear or not clear. And those people would be the ones that would rely upon it. Mr. Frank never alleged that there was a mistake in the warranty deed. If this was a mistaken warranty deed, that's one thing. But the fact is that he put his name on the warranty deed. He's the one that had the warranty deed drafted. He's the one that took Ms. Wilhoit to the closing agent. There is no doubt that this was a gift. He never showed anything else other than a gift. But after Ms. Wilhoit found another gentleman friend and married him, this changed the way Mr. Franks considered the gift. He determined then it was no longer a gift. there is a burden on this, on the court, on the trial court, protect the integrity of our system as far as our contracts and our deed system. We've got a system set up where if there is a issue, it should be under a written issue and not under parole evidence as far as warranty deeds go. Our system has been in place for several hundred years, I guess, as far as the deeds go. You just don't go behind a deed that's been filed, and you freely and voluntarily filed it. If it were me and I freely and voluntarily filed a deed, I would not expect somebody to say, well, or if I wanted to change it, I could go in and change it. This deed was a deed that he had drafted, and there is nothing other than his statements in trial, which my client was unable to cross-examine very well. She did not know how to object. I think in a way we all owe our duty to protect her as an elderly person. It's almost like an elderly abuse case, except both of them are elderly. She did not know that she needed to have a substantial knowledge of the law to object to the questions being asked by Mr. Frank's attorney, who was ably doing his job. She did not know that she could object to hearsay. She did not know how to present her side of the story after Mr. Frank's attorney ably objected to her testimony, because it was hearsay and other issues that she had. And so what here is a deed that is before the court. I've had a copy of it in number five of my exhibits, which shows that is a deed that is in both their names, and at least half of that property is hers, was given to her. Now, the other argument by Mr. Churn is that she didn't argue that this was a gift. There are several ways to give a gift, and one is, if you, especially property, you've got to convey it. He conveyed it. There's no doubt he conveyed it. His name is signed to the deed. So that is a gift as far as he's concerned to Ms. Wilhoit. In regard to the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, I agree there is not a constitutional guarantee of an ineffective or counsel in a civil litigation. But in the situation where a person is 82 years old, I believe the court should look at that a little bit with a little bit of a jaundice eye to determine that these people need protection, if not from themselves, from other people, then from themselves. And this Ms. Wilhoit was there and did not know anything about trials other than the fact that she had seen it on TV. And I do believe that the court could have had some discretion to help her get an attorney, probably, which would have helped her to avoid at least part of the situation that went on in that courtroom.
How could the court have given her an attorney?
I'm sorry?
How could the court have helped her get an attorney?
Sent her to the legal aid services, West Texas Legal Aid, or some of the other legal aid services. She recommended that she try those routes or those avenues, or just, you know, maybe Ms. Wilhoit, you really might not want to do this more strongly than maybe to a person much younger than herself. And in conclusion, you know, I'd like the court at least to find that half of that property was a gift to her. I do believe that also was in some of the motions that her first attorney had. But the deed certainly shows that it was a gift to her. Thank you.
Counsel, I have a question for you.
I'm sorry.
What happened to the Ellis County property?
Ennis County, it's Ennis. That property was sold, and according to her, Mr. Frank had told her that she needed to keep the money so she could have some extra money to live on. She put that in a trust account, is what I understand.
She did get the money that was proceeds of the sale of the Ennis County property.
I understand that she did.
You know the amount of that sale?
I'm sorry?
You know the amount of the sales price? I see in the record, there's some record about that Ennis County property was maybe worth $170,000 or something like that.
I think that was, it was close to that, and I don't know what the in settlement was. I believe Mr. Chern has an in settlement in his documentation.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Dan Chern for Appellee Howard Frank. First, if I may.
Can I go right to you with the.
Please.
Your Exhibit 7, is that the actual sales?
Yes, Your Honor.
The certificate and sale price was about $206,000.
$678.01. Yes, Your Honor.
And was that it shows that I can't tell how much money actually went to the seller.
That is the settlement amount, Your Honor. It actually sold for quite a bit more than that. I think it was $220,000 that it sold for.
If we look at Plaintiff's Exhibit 7, I think it tells us on the upper left-hand side.
$220,000 is the sale price. Okay, thank you, sir.
Certainly, Your Honor.
And cash to sell for $206,000.
Yes, sir. Thank you. And I was actually going to use that point to address Mrs. Wilhoit's position that Mrs. Katie's position that Mrs. Wilhoit didn't do a good job. She couldn't do a good job. She fired her counsel because she said she didn't want to pay them any more money. I get that. I certainly understand that, having had clients tell me that myself. But she did have the means, and she decided that this case was about who was telling the truth. And really, that's our contention, our essential contention as it relates to the $145,000 promise to repay is that the posture that we went to trial on was who's telling the truth. And that suited us just fine from the standpoint of we had a case that involved a sale of real estate from a third party to Mr. Frank. And nobody disputes, by the way, that actually happened. The title actually transferred from third party to Mr. Frank. Mr. Frank put the deed in his name and his sister's name because, as he said during trial, that was his idea of how he would maintain control over the property to make sure that, in fact, he was paid back. He did not, as he testified, he did not seek counsel. He did not, as Appellant correctly points out, he did not seek a lien. He did not seek a mortgage. In his mind, that somehow equated to control.
I'm confused. He put it in her name to make sure he maintained control?
No, he put it in his and her name.
Well,
he kept his name.
Why put her name on there if his purpose is to maintain control and make sure he got paid some money he believed he was owed?
Because he didn't know what he was doing, Your Honor. There won't be, I cannot offer this court, or could I offer the trial court, any logical reason as to why he would not just put it in his name and say, pay me back. And when you do, I'll write you a deed. Or do a deed of trust. There was no deed of trust. It was just a warranty deed. Why not do it that way? That's the simplest way. And I counseled Mr. Frank coming in after the fact that for $1,500, this would have all gone away a lot quicker. There is no good reason I can offer this court as to why he did it the way he did it, other than those are the facts that walked in the door. So the only question was can we convince a trier of fact that they had this agreement, number one, and two, that Mrs. Wilhoit didn't live up to her agreement. And so our position here before this court is that was the posture that Mrs. Wilhoit was comfortable with going to trial on, and in fact did go to trial on. That's what we tried before the court. Those were testimony that was given to the court as a finder of fact and the arguments that were made. In fact, in a motion for new trial, I think the only issue raised there was I didn't know what I was doing. I had ineffective assistance of counsel. Again, nothing with the statute of frauds, and the case law is very clear. It's a perfectly legitimate defense. The burden is on the defendant, but you can waive it. You can lose it if you don't do anything to bring it to the trial court's attention, to argue it, to object something. And this court, I relied on one of the cases out of from this court. I think it was Steger v. Not municipal, but Munster Drilling. The facts of the case involved, and Steger, it's another Texas land and oil case that reads like, as it passes from 1920 to present, reads like almost Old Testament genealogy. But the bottom line as it relates here is that this court held that the appellant raised on appeal an issue of statute of frauds. And this court said, you can't bring it here for the first time. It's not that she didn't plead it in the Steger case. It's not that it wasn't pled below. It just was never argued, urged, or anything of the sort. And that's really our posture here as it relates to the promise to pay back the $145,000 and change.
Was there a motion for summary judgment?
There was. It was heard. It was denied.
And was the issue statute of fraud?
It was. They raised it as an affirmative defense, and their counsel, Ms. Wilhoyt, had good counsel, competent counsel, and they raised that statute of frauds defense in their summary judgment. I believe the summary judgment is part of the record. Now, when while I didn't see anything in appellant's brief about the fact that, well, if it was raised in, or in a reply brief to my response, that if it was raised in summary judgment, that resurrects it or keeps it fresh, perhaps for an appeal under 38, the rules of appellate procedure. So I turned a few pages, and really the only thing I could find that came close to helping on that was that if a party with a burden loses on summary judgment and then goes to trial, you don't get to complain about what happened on summary judgment. Basically, your complaint is going to be, if you don't like the results of the trial, what happened there. We don't get to go back. And so that was about as close as I could get to anything that would really help us here on that. But because the trial court was never given an opportunity at trial or post-trial to do anything with the statute of frauds defense, it would be inappropriate now to come in and say, well, help us out here. And I appreciate appellant's position and argument today that in a large part what this comes down to is that Mrs. Wilhoyt decided to represent herself because she didn't want to start touching that $206,000. Well, everybody's held to those standards. We all know what happens when we walk up to the bench where a party is pro se. The judge gives the admonishment, you're going to be held to the same rules. That's exactly what happened here. And Mrs. Wilhoyt decided to proceed. Again, because I don't mean any disrespect, but I having had clients do this before and then come to me after the fact, sometimes it's the penny wise and pound foolish. I think Mr. Frank is guilty of that, frankly, my client. He'll save $1,500 and then spend the next year and a half paying the likes of me. So we asked the court then to leave that judgment in place. The trial court heard an argument about who should be believed. The trial court sat as a fact finder, judged credibility, and found Mr. Frank's story to be more credible. That he would not have just taken $145,000, paid out a house while he's still making mortgage payments on his home. And so we asked the court to leave that in place. The $10,000 loan from Point Bank to Mrs. Wilhoyt, appellant has tried to characterize that as a loan between Mr. Frank and Mrs. Wilhoyt. It's not a loan. He pledged his CD. We put in the evidence into the record of how much he had to pay. I think it was $10,500 when it was all said and done. We stood in the shoes of the bank after the bank broke the CD to pay back the loan that Mrs. Wilhoyt refused to pay. And we asked the judge, the trial judge, we want to get paid back for that. again, no, nothing particularly controversial, I thought, in that particular part of the trial. And again, I haven't seen any argument or any rationale presented by appellant as to why this court should overturn it. Again, I think a lot of this comes down to, well, Mrs. Wilhoit is elderly, and she's 82 and elderly, and, you know, she watched L.A. Law years ago, and now we need a foot or a head note in West somewhere, or Lexis, that says, well, if you're past a certain age, you get the help of the trial court to help try your case. There's no such rule, nor I think most of us would agree should there be. Or if there should be, maybe it's not the province of the courts to make those determinations. That's getting far afield. Again, we ask the court to keep that part of the judgment as well, to affirm that part of the judgment, and to... I think the only other issue that was raised as a tangent to the ineffective counsel was attorney's fees. And I'll address that if the court sees fit. Otherwise, I'll take any questions. And if the court doesn't have any questions, I'll tender my time back to the court.
I'd like to understand what happened in terms of the Aubrey property. And I see the title moved from the seller to Mr. Wilhoit and
Mr. Frank, Your Honor.
Mr. Frank. And what happened after that?
That's
the title to the property.
That's where it sits. It moved from seller, the third party, unrelated third party, title moved from that unrelated third party to my client, Mr. Frank, and appellant, Mrs. Wilhoit. And as we stand here today, that's how it sits. And in fact, Mr. Frank testified that he was agreeing, stipulating, I tried to put it as strong as possible, that upon repayment, if he can actually collect on the judgment, he will, as the deal always was, deed the rest of it over to his sister.
I didn't see that in the judgment.
It's not in the judgment. It's not in the judgment ordering him to do that, but that was his testimony, that he's not looking for double recovery. He just wants to recover the $145,000, and then he's obligated to, he recognized that he's obligated to tender over the rest of that interest.
So the property in Aubrey, is it occupied at the present time?
It is, Your Honor, by Mrs. Wilhoit and her husband.
Okay. And in terms of the judgment amount at $148,000, was there some credit against the $145,000 amount of money that he cashed out of his life insurance to get the proceeds to buy the house? I'm looking at.
No, Your Honor, he actually just took the money out of his life savings to purchase the home. But there was no, if I'm understanding the court's question correctly, there were no credits or anything to give against the whatever the amount was, and I apologize, I can't think of the exact amount. But
so the judgment amount, when you look at the judgment that the court actually rendered, is the judgment for everything that Mr. Frank was trying to recover for.
Yes, Your Honor.
And otherwise, the property was not encumbered by any document or documentation from Ms. Wilhoit to Mr. Frank.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
So his agreement to deed it to her in full upon the end of the money also is not in writing. Is that what you're talking about?
That is correct. Appellant is correct. There are no writings between these two that states, I, Howard Frank, will purchase this house and put our names on it, and you, Mildred Wilhoit, my sister, agree to pay me back, and upon payment, I agree to. There's no version of that, no partial writing or a writing of even any part of that. No, Your Honor, I think, well, let me break that down. First, as it relates to this final judgment, that's correct. But I think as an equitable matter, I don't mean as in life is fair, I mean as in a suit being brought, I think Mr. Frank would lose that case if she pays, if in fact she could pay him back, and then he says, you know what, I want that double recovery after all.
You're saying you asked him that question under oath on the record, and he said he would do it?
He's under oath on the record, I was explicit as could be, and he said, yes, I recognize that I have to deed this back to her, or this remaining interest. I don't get to keep both. And I wanted the trial court to sitting as fact finder, to see we were not looking for any kind of windfall. We just wanted to get paid back what had been promised. Thank you, Your Honors.
Is there any response?
Yes, Your Honor. Basically, Ms. Wilhoit, whenever she started to testify, was shut down. She could not, it would be hard for a court to judge her credibility if she's not able to testify. You know, like I said, Mr. Churn ably objected to a lot of her testimony. So as far as the agreement or whether there was an agreement, that I do not feel like, ask the court to consider whether or not she was able to get across to the court the fact that they evidently didn't have a meeting of the minds, first of all, in order to have any kind of agreement or parole evidence to a contract, and that's what Mr. Franks is claiming is a contract, you have to have a meeting of the minds. When her testimony was shut down, there was no way the court could continue to listen and hear what she had to say. And she finally just said, I don't know what to say. Because every time she started to testify, there was objections. Yes, she took that on herself to go ahead, because she told me she had no money. And the only thing that I can, as a person, envision making things just as far as people who have no money is for the courts to be able to help them find counsel who can represent them. There was no written document. The statute of frauds, I feel like, states that you cannot render there a contract when there's no written documents, and to use parole evidence to get around that violates a statute of frauds, and that is not just a little bit of money. Thank you. Any questions?
I have a question. Okay. Yes, I do. What was the date of the trial?
That's in March, I believe. I believe
it was March. Let me find the final judgment.
March 30th was the date of the final judgment. I believe it was a two-day trial. Is that correct? One day? One-day trial, Your Honor?
March 30th of what year?
Of 2010.
And if this settlement date on the sale of the Ennis property was in September of 2008,
Your Honor.
She had cash to the seller of $206,000. Wasn't that an election on her part not to hire counsel and attempt to represent herself?
I believe she's that money was placed in an irrevocable trust, and so I don't think that she could get to it, Your Honor, is what my understanding
Some
of it is.
Some trustee denied her the right to have money withdrawn out of a trust account or defend herself in a lawsuit?
I have no idea if she, you know, I mean, I didn't ask her if she had asked.
About that. I can't imagine anyone would say. Yeah. You're going to represent yourself, 82-year-old lady, giving you the money out of this trust.
I think probably she didn't, it was irrevocable in her mind. It's the same thing as going to trial on her own. That's something she's decided she can't do if it's irrevocable. That's just what I envision of an 82-year-old lady, and I didn't ask her that question. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument and your briefs. Your case is submitted. We appreciate you coming here to answer our questions. It's been helpful. And we'll be in recess. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas.